Tom Woods Show, episode 1214.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Men, if you want a smooth, close, comfortable shave, check out Harry's Razors, the official razor of the Tom Woods Show. Harry's has created a trial offer for you to check them out. Go grab yours at harrys.com/woods. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here talking to Mark Thornton, the guy who predicted the housing bust. He was talking about the housing bubble for years, did some really, really great work on that topic. And he has a brand new book out featuring a foreword by your host here called The Skyscraper Curse and How Austrian Economists Predicted Every Major Economic Crisis of the Last Century. You're going to hate me after this episode, if you don't hate me already, for recommending so many books to you. I know a lot of you folks out there are getting frustrated because that pile is growing and growing, and I'm not doing a thing to help you because I'm making it grow all the more all the time. But it's a great book. That's why I wrote the foreword to it. Mark Thornton is a senior fellow of the Mises Institute. He also teaches economics at Auburn University. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom. It's great to be back on your show.
There are many topics to cover in your book. I love a book like this. You learn a ton by reading The Skyscraper Curse. We'll get to skyscrapers in just a second. I think in order to understand the skyscraper thesis, we need to step back one step to talk about Austrian business cycle theory and then see how this question of skyscrapers, which when the correlation was first pointed out in 1999 between skyscraper records and the verge of economic downturns, it seemed like an interesting curiosity, and that was that. And you actually showed there is an economic explanation as to why these things ought to be connected. Let's make that connection after explaining how the Austrians explain where the boom-bust cycle comes from.
That's right, Tom. When Andrew Lawrence released his report about skyscrapers, I could see Austrian business cycle theory embedded or as an explanatory phenomenon for this curse. And Austrian business cycle theory looks at relative prices in the economy. It looks at the behavior of interest rates in the economy as the most important price in our entire economy is the interest rate. And in modern times, for at least the last century here in the United States, the Federal Reserve has been in control of interest rates, and it can raise them as much as it wants, and it can lower them as much as it wants. And unfortunately, this is what causes the modern business cycle in modern economics. When the Fed, the central bank, lowers interest rates artificially for extended period of time, it encourages entrepreneurs to do the wrong thing. It encourages much more investment in much more longer-term projects that are what I call advanced technologies. In other words, they're being created and built before their time is ready. And because of this mistake during the low interest rate period, what happens is that eventually resources are too scarce, interest rates start to rise, money becomes short, and a lot of these mail investments that took place, these bad investments that took place during the boom, are later revealed to be busts in the economy, and people go bankrupt, people lose their jobs, and the economy is set back in the aggregate.
Now, there are a few features of the skyscraper question that can fit in nicely with the story you just told, and as to why it's not, as we say, just an interesting curiosity that we see records for the tallest skyscrapers being set just as the economy is set to come back down again. So try to fit those two stories together for us.
That's right, Tom. There are features in skyscrapers that change during the boom period when interest rates are low that you can actually see. Whereas much of the phenomenon of the Austrian business cycle is very difficult to determine what's really an advanced technology, what's really a bad investment. But in skyscrapers, everything becomes much clearer. And they're what I call, or what other people have called, Cantillon effects. In these record-setting skyscrapers, And the first one is that low interest rates, and this is all very well known in real estate circles, low interest rates cause land prices to rise. And so many of your audience have probably seen more signs for land for sale these last couple of years. And when land prices go up, well, that encourages builders and entrepreneurs to build taller buildings, because you have to stretch out the cost of the land over more square feet in the building. And so low interest rates cause higher land prices, and higher land prices cause builders and entrepreneurs to build higher. The second phenomenon is that low interest rates, they cause new technology to be brought about in the building of skyscrapers. And so in order to build taller buildings, you need new technologies like better elevators, faster elevators. You need smaller air conditioning systems. You need, you know, it involves everything in the building, plumbing and so on. And so all building systems have to be reinvented to accommodate these new record-setting skyscrapers. And as a consequence, all the suppliers have to go out and come up with new products, new technologies. And so everybody is in this business of bringing about advanced technologies. And so it's very clear in the building of these record-setting skyscrapers how interest rates manipulate the economy in ways which are completely unsustainable.
All right, before we go on, can you just give us a few examples of skyscrapers and the dates so that we can see the pattern?
Sure. In the first crisis of the 20th century, which was the Panic of 1907, the Singer Building in New York and the Metropolitan Life Building in New York set records just as the panic began. Then, of course, there's the infamous Great Depression, in which the Wall Street Building set a new record in 1929. The Chrysler Building set a new record in 1930. And then, of course, the Empire State Building set a record in 1931. And so these skyscraper curses tend to come in clusters, not surprisingly. And then, of course, in the stagflation of the 1970s, just as that was getting underway, we saw the World Trade Tower 1 and World Trade Tower 2 set records. And then right after that, the Sears Building in Chicago set a record right before the stagflation. That was an awful period. That's when I was growing up. High rates of inflation and unemployment. And then, of course, double-digit interest rates and unemployment rates in the early 1980s. And then most recently, the Burj Khalifa Tower in Dubai set the record in 2007. And so I was calling for a major crisis in the economy in 2007 as a result of that. And of course, just general knowledge about Austrian business cycle theory with stock markets at all-time highs. And everybody pretty much laughed me off on that one. But of course, it came to pass that not only was Dubai in the Middle East an economic basket case, but of course, the crisis spread around the world to the United States and Europe and beyond. And so, you know, I've been looking at the history of the skyscraper curse, and I've gone back into the 19th century and found more examples of record-setting skyscrapers. And of course, we're living in a period where skyscrapers are going up all around the world. And so it's a very interesting connection that we're living through right now, not just in history.
Let's talk about predictions, because of course, you were just saying that you used some of this and some other information to call, to at least say that there was a very, very strong possibility of a major downturn around 2007. And then you had also been writing about the housing bubble for several years by that point. So I definitely want to get back to that. But one of the things that Austrians sometimes boast about is that they were out in front predicting certain downturns, but particularly not just any old downturns, but downturns that followed years of assurances by the mainstream that maybe booms don't have to be followed by busts anymore. There was a confidence in the 20s that by managing the consumer price level, they had maybe somehow figured out some secret sauce to get prosperity without the bust. And then likewise, in the 1960s going into 1970, there were predictions like by Arthur Oaken that maybe we've gone past the business cycle at this point in our history. And then Alan Greenspan, the 1990s, even said maybe booms don't have to be followed by busts after all, and then you get the dot-com bust. So it's interesting that those, not just any old garden variety recession, but those times in particular where everybody, or there's a mania that maybe the economists have solved the problem of the boom bust cycle, the Austrians were out in front. But how do you, and I want to talk about specific examples of that, but how do you answer the claim that, of course, the Austrians are going to be out in front because they're always saying that the economy is going to turn down? Sure, once in a while, they're going to be right, but 90% of the time, they're wrong.
Well, that's a good point, Tom. What Austrians do is they look at what the Federal Reserve has been doing and then say that the conditions are correct, that a crisis could occur in the economy. So I started warning people about what might happen back in, I think it was 2013 or 14, because even back then the conditions were fairly ripe that a crisis could occur and unemployment could increase. And the conditions, those conditions have only gotten much worse. Austrians don't know when the crisis is going to occur. And we generally don't have anything in Austrian theory that tells us how big the bust is actually going to be. So there are limitations on Austrian theory and its application to real world analysis. But when you look at the mainstream, they're completely blinded by this. And they're completely boastful about what they have so-called accomplished in the economy when that just really isn't so. So if you go back into the 1920s, you had Irving Fisher, the most prominent of all American economists, being interviewed on a weekly basis in places like the New York Times, and him boasting that his philosophy or theory was being used by the Federal Reserve to smooth out the business cycle, and that the prosperity that they were experiencing in the 1920s was completely real, and that you don't have anything to worry about, that we're in a permanent plateau of prosperity. And he was saying this not only right before the crash, but even long after the crash. He thought it was just a mistake based on psychology in the market that would soon correct itself. Whereas you had Ludwig von Mises writing in 1924 and 1928 in a book-like treatment, criticizing Fisher's approach is unworkable, and that it would soon result in very large imbalances in the economy. Mises was clearly right. He explained exactly why Fisher's approach was wrong. And even Fisher in 1932 admitted that there were imperfections in things like price levels and price indexes, and that they weren't able to accurately measure it. So when you look at the big picture, the Austrians are clearly right. They have limitations, but the mainstream approach of the Fischnerians, the Keynesians, the Friedmans are all wrong. And as a matter of fact, I think the most recent boast by Milton Friedman in late 2006 on the Charlie Rose show that the Federal Reserve was doing a great job, the economy was firing on all cylinders, and he applauded the Federal Reserve and what they were doing and the approach that they were taking of, you know, manipulating the money supply and interest rates. So on the eve of the housing debacle, Friedman was praising the Federal Reserve and the monetarist approach that he and Ben Bernanke were taking to control the economy. So, you know, the Austrians have limitations, but I think on balance, if you're fair, at least we're on the right side of the ball, and the mainstream consisting of Irving Fisher, Milton Friedman, and the Keynesians have been absolutely and completely wrong.
I learned from you about Arthur Oaken, who had been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in the late 60s, and his book, The Political Economy of Prosperity, that came out, I think, in 1970. And in that book, he more or less said, well, through wise economic stewardship and through the application of modern economic understanding, we've been able to steer our way through the business cycle, and we've conquered it. And 1 month later, 1 month after that book came out, the recession was officially declared to have begun. So there was a kind of funny poetic justice to that after that kind of boast. So can you say something about that in particular, the going into the late 60s and the early 70s? Now, that's at a time when Mises was quite old at that point. His work was somewhat winding down. And Hayek, I suppose, wrote some economics, but he had moved on to social philosophy and other topics. Were there Austrians at that time warning? I suppose Murray Rothbard, right?
Absolutely. And that's a new feature of this book, is looking at what the Austrians did in the late 1960s. During the 1960s, the Keynesians completely took over. They started a bubble in the economy with artificially low interest rates. And so we had a tremendous boom in the 1960s. The stock market was up, new technology, all sorts of things were happening. And Arthur Oaken, the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors, he was boasting that, the Keynesians were unafraid to use these new techniques, and that we could write off the business cycle. It would no longer be a topic to be studied in the future. And he belittled the old school economist who thought that what you needed was a market approach to money and interest rates, and that you should balance the budget and government should be small. He belittled the Austrians without naming them, of course. And just as he published his book, proclaiming all of this glory for the Keynesian approach, the economy went into a recession that lasted basically 12 years of pain in the economy, tremendous losses in the stock market, and all sorts of other bad things. When I went back and re-looked at this period, though, I didn't remember the Austrians doing anything, because, of course, I was too young at the time to experience them directly. But on review, I found that Murray Rothbard was spot on. I mean, he was spot on in his writings at the time. He predicted basically everything that was going to happen. He was absolutely correct. Henry Hazlitt, I thought he was retired, but he really retired from one publication and started writing for the Los Angeles Times. He wrote something, almost 200 articles for the Los Angeles Times after he retired. And he was writing about the exact right topics of inflation, of budgets gone bananas, about the Federal Reserve, about artificially low interest rates, about the Bretton Woods system, which he correctly predicted would collapse. Murray Rothbard wrote not only a pamphlet describing boom-bust cycles from the Austrian perspective in 1969, but he wrote prolifically in other publications describing exactly what was happening and what would happen, and he was absolutely on the mark. And then, of course, Ludwig von Mises, who was very old and near his death, was out actually giving public lectures warning that what the Keynesians were doing was wrong. It was going to cause all sorts of problems. It's going to cause inflation. It's going to cause recession. It was going to be the undoing of the gold standard. Again, he was just absolutely spot on. And then even Hayek, who had disappeared from economics long ago, he was in Austria writing about non-economic topics. He got back involved in the 1970s. He wrote several pamphlets on monetary reform, on what to do with the mess that the Keynesians had created in the 1960s. And so it was great to sort of relive some of his publications, his pamphlets, the wonderful monograph that Suda Shenoy put together, where she took bits and pieces of his earlier writings and somehow sewed them all together seamlessly and produced just a wonderful pamphlet. And then, of course, you had Ron Paul and the Gold Commission, which did great work trying to bring back the real gold standard. And then, of course, when you get to the end of the period of the 1970s, you have Lou Rockwell and Murray Rothbard putting together the Mises Institute and finally creating an institutional home for Austrian economics and libertarian political theory, Nobody thought that that was going to work, by the way. Everybody was dead set against Lou Rockwell. And Lou proved him wrong. He brought the Austrian school back, and we're stronger today than probably we ever have been. And so I'm very optimistic. You know, I got into this business of Austrian economics at exactly that period of time in the early 1980s. And it was a wasteland. There was nothing there. And I've seen the growth that Lou has brought about, and it's just enormous. And I'm just thrilled, and I'm extremely optimistic going forward.
I want to fast forward to the housing bubble, because that's an area where you also built up your reputation, because you had been warning about the housing bubble for years before it was on the radar of most people, before it hit. So I want to talk about your chapter in here about what causes housing bubbles. And I'll say that at that time, I guess by the time I moved, I was at the Mises Institute from 06 until 2010. So by the time I got there, you had already been writing about the housing bubble for a couple of years. But at that time, my oldest daughter was only 3 years old. So as she got older and as we passed through the crisis and she learned that there was something wrong. She didn't know what the economy was, but she knew that a lot of folks had lost their jobs and were having trouble paying bills and things like that. And that made her sad. And so the thing I would tell her, because we would come and visit, she'd come to my office once in a while, and you had the office right next to mine. I would point in at your office and I would say, now, if only people had listened to this guy, we could have avoided a lot of this. So she grew up with this sort of weirdly semi-divine view of Mark Thornton because of that. So anyway, where do housing bubbles come from? Can it just come from a mania? Let's start with that. Can it just be self-reinforcing that a lot of people think they can do really well in real estate and that just reinforces itself? How is that not an adequate explanation?
Well, that can happen. You know, on an individual level, literally anything can happen because we have, you know, free human choice. But in the aggregate, that's extremely unlikely to happen. And I don't know of any circumstances under which it has happened where everybody simultaneously gets the psychological urge to go in and buy up excess housing. Generally speaking, the market has a self-reinforcing mechanism that if everybody tries to invest more or to invest in new advanced technologies, well, the interest rate is going to go up, the necessary labor wages are going to go up, the necessary materials are going to increase in price. And so it has a self-suppressing mechanism to it. You can only get an aggregate bubble in the economy when interest rates are driven artificially low and held there for an extended period of time. And what the Federal Reserve does is essentially has a moving price ceiling on interest rates. And if interest rates tend to move above where they want them to, they just throw more and more money and credit at the market, and the market continues to absorb it all. And that's where you get the tendency for bubbles to develop. It certainly booms in the economy, and bubbles in certain markets can occur. And so other people pointed to various other things specific to the housing market, like credit default swaps, the Community Reinvestment Act, all sorts of things that are specific to housing. And I admit there certainly are many, many specific benefits that homeowners get that do not apply in other areas of the economy. So the way I explained it is the Federal Reserve causes the booms and the bubbles, but the name of the bubble can be specific to certain areas that the government is intentionally trying to funnel the money into. So housing is an adjective that are caused by all these rules and regulations and these new markets that have been supported by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You know the story. But the Fed is what creates the bubbles. So the rules and regulations, they can tip the balance in one direction in the economy or another. But bubbles can only be created by the artificial interest rates caused by the Federal Reserve.
A lot more to talk about with Mark Thornton. Let's take a minute to thank my friends at Harry's Razors for supporting the show. These folks have top-notch razors, super sharp blades, which is the key thing that you need in a razor. And that's what gives you and me a nice close shave. They're made out of durable steel that lasts. Folks who started Harry's bought a factory that's been making some of the highest quality blades in the world for over 95 years. And Harry's offers their blades at a price much lower than the leading brand, just $2 per blade compared to $4 or more. They cut out the middleman and sell directly to you. If you don't love your shave, let Harry's know within 30 days and they'll give you a full refund. They've got a nice trial offer for you to give it a shot. Get a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Listeners of my show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/woods. Make sure you go to harrys.com/woods to redeem your offer and let them know I sent you to help support the show. Tell me about the rational expectations critique of Austrian business cycle theory. What are they saying is wrong with it?
The rational expectation theory is basically that the marketplace as a whole is always rational. It's always based on fundamental factors in the economy, and markets never go wrong. And so basically, they are free market. They are not as bad as some other schools of economic thought. They think that things like booms and busts in the economy are caused by technological shocks. So that if a positive technological shock happens in the economy, then you'll get an expansion or a boom in the economy. And then if something negative happens in the economy regarding a technological shock, then you'll get a recession. And their classic example of a negative technological shock was the oil shortages of the 1970s that caused the economy to fade away into recession. But, you know, even if that was true, even if it was just technological shocks that caused boom and bust, well, their approach has no predictive of value because the shocks are beyond their knowledge, and they have no policy cure to either prevent or to restore the economy from a negative economic shock. And so they're better than the Keynesians, but with their the Keynesians have a psychological approach, but the rational expectations approach doesn't really get you anywhere in terms of understanding the business cycle or preparing for bad parts of the cycle or not. And actually, the Austrian business cycle theory encompasses both the psychological Keynesians and the technological shocks of the rational expectation school. And with respect to the rational expectation school, look at what happened during the housing bubble. Well, there were, people were psychologically, improved, and they had a great view. They were engaging in speculative behavior of the Keynesians' point of view. But it was really the artificially low interest rates which allowed that psychological euphoria to take place. And also, of course, there were technological shocks during the boom that the Austrian approach anticipates happening. We saw a lot of new technologies during the housing bubble take place, such as in skyscraper construction. And we also saw technological shocks in financial markets as banks and financial firms created new technologies of borrowing and lending money through mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps. All that was new financial technology that you would expect when the Federal Reserve is feeding the economy enormous amounts of money. You have to create new loans somehow. You have to give loan money to people with poor credit. And so banks were dealing with this disbursement of massive amounts of credit to worse and worse creditors by creating these new financial products. So the Austrian approach basically encompasses the fact that, you know, there are psychological changes and there are technological changes, but why do they all happen at once? Well, the general economic explanation is the Austrian approach to the Federal Reserve creating artificially low interest rates. They don't have an economic cause to their business cycle. They have a psychological story or they have a technological story, but they don't even have an economic story.
What you've described for us is indeed what we might call, I guess, the rational expectations school. Sometimes that term is used more loosely when we say that there's a rational expectations problem with Austrian business cycle theory, and you've got a section in the book on this, the argument being that shouldn't entrepreneurs, after a while, cotton on to what the Fed is up to? Why do they keep getting suckered into getting into these overheated economies with super low interest rates where the configuration of the economy is unsustainable and is going to come undone and they're going to be caught in the middle of it? Why don't they sit out? Why don't they say, you know what, we're not going to do massive expansion during this time. We're going to let other people fail and we're just going to sit on the sidelines. So what makes them make the error over and over again? Shouldn't they, as good entrepreneurs in a capitalist system, figure out what's happening?
That's a great question, Tom. It's absolutely a very important question to answer because, you know, the Austrians believe in that people are rational to a certain extent as well. When it comes to business cycle theory, some people do learn. Some people do sit on the sidelines. Some people do pull back and resist the temptations of the Federal Reserve. The problem is that new people can enter the market and take advantage of those low interest rates. So you will have a few people who have learned sit on the sideline and warn people not to enter the market. Like, for example, a non-economic one was that Jimmy Rogers would appear on CNBC and warn people of the trouble ahead and of the bad policy. Well, CNBC just took him off the air as somebody with a negative attitude, where all these new people were coming in saying, buy, 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 buy this stock, buy that stock. And so very often the people who do the warning get pushed out of the marketplace. I had a story, a friend of mine was in the banking business and, during a previous housing bubble, and he withheld giving out too many loans and only gave out loans to people he knew with good credit. And he lost his job too, because there's always bankers who are willing to come into the marketplace to give away these loans. So it's not always the same people. You actually can learn about the Austrian theory of the business cycle, and you can protect yourself from some of the worst aspects of it, but it doesn't prevent new people from coming in and looking at some old model in the banking business and saying, you know, we should be making loans at this rate to this many customers. And so the good guys get pushed out as new people come into the marketplace and don't resist the money flowing, emanating from the Federal Reserve.
I've heard a couple of different ways of addressing it. I mean, your point that the people who warn and sit out wind up getting taken to the cleaners, because what happens, and this is an argument that was made in an article, and I can't remember if it's in the QJ or in the Review of Austrian Economics, but years ago, a couple of guys, Tony Carilli and Greg Dempster, did an article on this where they said, the problem is if all your competitors are all in during the boom, and they take advantage of the artificially low interest rates to expand, and you're just going to sit there. Yeah, there's a chance that they might get caught out in it, but there's also a chance that they might just get ahead of you, and you're just sitting there. So it leads even the otherwise sensible entrepreneurs to become, you know, more gamblers because they feel like they've got to do it to survive. Now, Bob Murphy has been less convinced by that because he feels like at the heart of Austrian business cycle theory is the idea of entrepreneurial error. Not that entrepreneurs go in with their eyes wide open, knowing that it's probably a Fed boom, but what are they going to do if all their, you know, all their competitors are participating? They're going to have to. That doesn't seem to be part of the spirit of the Austrian theory. The spirit is entrepreneurial error. And so here, another way of thinking about it could be that to say, well, entrepreneurs ought to figure out what interest rates ought to be, but that seems like an unreasonable thing to ask them to do. It'd be like having an economy with no prices and saying, well, look, these people are entrepreneurs. They ought to be able to assign prices in the economy. No, even entrepreneurs can't do that. That's why we have a market.
Absolutely. You know, I think in the book, I address this literature where there are several explanations of how you can look at, you know, the rational entrepreneur in this kind of environment. And, you know, the Austrian theory, the whole approach is based on the idea of clusters of entrepreneurial error. The artificially low interest rates induce these male investments, which are all errors in the economy. So your typical mainstream economist looks at the expansion boom as the good part of the economy and the recession as the bad part, the thing to be feared and avoided at all, absolutely all costs, where the Austrian approach says, no, that's actually backwards. It's the artificially low interest rates causing male investments, which will be later revealed as a cluster of entrepreneurial error. That's the bad part. That's when we're making mistakes. And in the corrective recessions, that's where the economy is actually healing itself. Relative prices are moving resources to their most highly valued uses. And so that's the correction. That's the good part in the economy, where you more or less leave entrepreneurs alone and allow them to make the necessary adjustments to reallocate resources and to bring the economy back to full employment, basically.
Let's talk about 2018. Here we are in, I don't know when they would say the recovery began or what month of the expansion we're in, but we're in a very long expansion right now. Now, it's a weird expansion because there are some numbers that have been very weak through this expansion. It's very odd and it's slow and sluggish, but then there are numbers that are quite strong during the expansion. What's your assessment of where we are now and where we're going? Now, granted that, again, the Austrians don't claim to be able to time things, but what do you feel about the overall health of the economy in these years after the housing bust?
Well, my view is that a lot of the growth in the economy has been artificial since about 2010 or so. The Fed did not allow the economy to go into complete recovery. So we started out on a very weak basis. We started providing credit to people who otherwise would have had to liquidate their businesses. So this expansion has been weak because of that, because of the lack of a full recovery after the housing bubble. And since then, they've sort of stabilized the economy and set us off on this course of economic expansion. And most of your audience can probably look around in the cities that they live in and see a lot of new investments in their local economy. We have numerous extremely large buildings being built in the city of Auburn, where I live and where the Institute is located. And I've seen this phenomenon elsewhere around the economy, particularly in real estate. But, you know, there's also a lot of money that's going into other areas of the economy, such as social media, where they've been expanding and where it seems like every company in every space is doing well. And it's only the really, really old economy, like Kmart and Sears and Radio Shack. That really old economy is obviously suffering and collapsing. They don't have the customers and the resources. That's all been lured away into the newer leading edges, the advanced technologies of the modern economy. So I think that's an explanation for why it's been so weak. The reason it's been so long I think, is because of the hyperactive monetary policy by the Federal Reserve. Remember, I said earlier in the interview that I said the economy could have gone into crisis in 2013 or 2014, but what happened instead was completely new, untried monetary policy from the Federal Reserve. We had quantitative easing one, quantitative easing two, we had Operation Twist, and eventually we got to the point in recent times where interest rates actually went negative in places like Japan and Germany. And so that indicates an absolutely hyperdrive monetary policy with not only just setting low interest rates almost to zero, but the Federal Reserve and the European Bank and others, the Bank of Japan, force feeding their economy with credit and ultra low, near zero interest rates. And so the length of this expansion, I think, is because of that, because they've been just completely untried, unforeseen, unbelievable type of monetary policy that has pushed asset prices to all-time record highs, you know, just in an incredible fashion. The fact that government bonds in places like Italy and Spain, the pig countries of Europe, are so very, very low is ludicrous based on fundamental factors. But these outrageous monetary policies allowed that to continue. And so we're on life support. And, you know, they're feeding us the economy morphine and oxygen and, you know, all sorts of stimulants to keep it going. So I don't think it can last much longer. The economic fundamentals just to me say that it just can't go on much longer without a naturally induced corrective process happening.
Well, the book is The Skyscraper Curse and How Austrian Economists Predicted Every Major Economic Crisis of the Last Century. You can get it in several formats. You can get it in paperback, you can get it as an audiobook, and you can get it for free as a download, as a ebook style. And I'm going to link to all those things at tomwoods.com/1214. If you're too impatient to go even to that page, I can give you a shortcut. Mises.org/curse gets you to the free download of the book, and Mises.org/curse audio gets you to the audiobook version. But I'll link to all that at tomwoods.com/1214. Well, congratulations on the book, Mark. I'm glad a lot of this stuff that you've been writing over the years is now sitting here in one volume for people to learn from. If they didn't get it the first time in real time, then in retrospect, they could get it, and maybe they'll get it next time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom. And those links are for the free versions are temporary. So I urge the audience to get out there and get yours today.
Oh, okay. Well, that is good to know. All right. Well, the early bird gets the worm on this one. All right. Thanks, Mark. All right, folks, before I let you go, especially for you homeschoolers, brand new site you might want to check out. I cannot believe this domain name was available. Thishomeschool.com. Perfect. That is so great. I don't know how they thought of that. So simple, you would think it had to be taken. And apparently it wasn't. Well, Lindsay Schweitzer is an educational technology consultant and former math teacher who homeschools her three young children. And at thishomeschool.com, she blogs about educational activities and resources to help parents support their children's growth with intellectual rigor and strong libertarian values. And when you check out thishomeschool.com, you're just going to love it. It's laid out very nicely, wonderful posts on all different topics. So all different projects that you might do, whether it's gardening or cooking or sight words or games that facilitate motor development or bonding among siblings or learning letters or an activity for learning early math and learning about bones and the human body and so on. Fantastic site, a model for how you should do this. So check it out at thishomeschool.com. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1214. And if you would like to get publicity when you're about to start a website, make sure you get your web hosting through my link. You'll get the best price Bluehost has, and you'll get free publicity and other great bonuses from me. Check those all out at tomwoods.com/publicity. Watch for an excellent, excellent bonus episode this weekend from a mom of seven who has cracked the code about how to be able to work without leaving your kids at home. She says, darn it, I'm going to work from this computer regardless of what it takes. And man, is she good at it. So check that out tomorrow. See you soon.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.